from VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the state of religious freedom around the world. Our guest, Anurima Bhargava, chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF, an independent bipartisan federal government entity created in 1998 by the U.S. Congress to monitor, analyze, and report on religious freedom abroad. USERF recently released its 2021 annual report, which, according to a press release, documents developments during 2020, including significant progress in countries such as Sudan. Meantime, other nations implemented laws and policies that further target religious communities and in some cases amount to genocide and crimes against humanity, such as China's actions against Uyghur and other Turkic Muslims in Xinjiang province. We will talk with USERF Chairwoman Anurima Bhargava, a civil rights lawyer with extensive experience in advocating for members of underrepresented communities, about the key findings in the 2021 annual report, which identified 14 countries to the State Department for designation as countries of particular concern, or CPCs, because their governments engage in or tolerate, quote, systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations, unquote. For the first time ever, the State Department designated Nigeria as a CPC in 2020, which USERF had been recommending since 2009. We had the pleasure of speaking to Anurima Bhargava back in January when she was vice chair of USERF, and we are delighted to welcome her back in her new position as chair of the commission. Anurima Bhargava joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Carol.
Anurima, let's start with the biggest takeaways, both the good and the bad, from the 2021 USERF report on international religious freedom.
So obviously the pandemic of 2020, I think there were multiple pandemics, but certainly the one that the entire world was enmeshed in is COVID. And I think in many ways that was the story even of what happened with religious communities around the world, which is that for communities that have been displaced or have been pushed out because of their practice of their religion or faith, like the Rohingya, we saw COVID devastating camps, places where people were congregated and didn't have the ability to move. We saw the ways in which those who were, some positive developments under COVID, where those who had been imprisoned for practicing their faith or advocating on behalf of those who do, that some of those folks were let out of prison because of the kinds of conditions in prisons around the world. But certainly at the same time, we saw people being detained, the kind of misinformation about COVID and who was spreading COVID often took religious overtones to it that ended up being the proliferation of hate and the targeting of religious communities. And then obviously, there are many ways in which the kinds of restrictions that were placed, certainly on religious gatherings, which had public health justifications for it under international law, but there were lots of ways in which the ability to practice religion for many was curtailed in 2020. And in fact, there were places around the world where the internet was cut off in religious communities. And so we saw the impact of COVID, but in some ways, the impact was a deepening of some of the concerns that we already had about the ways in which religious communities are marginalized and targeted.
That's terrific. And we'll get into details. For example, now I'd like to focus on the most egregious violators of freedom of religion or belief, particularly those countries that actually implemented laws and policies which targeted religious communities and in some cases amount to genocide and crimes against humanity.
We would be remiss not to start with China, because of what we have seen for many years is the ways in which China has continued persecution of the Uyghurs. We don't have that much information or any information at all in some ways about what has been happening with the Uyghurs over the course of the last year. But there are a number of concerns about living conditions and, frankly, the health and safety of Uyghurs who have been placed in camps. And as the United States recognized over the past year, that what's been happening with the Uyghurs constitutes genocide. And so the Uyghurs are certainly a community, a population that we have been advocating for and remain gravely concerned about, you know, what the conditions have been for the Uyghurs over the past year in particular. And then, as I mentioned, I mean, the Rohingya, you know, who have been pushed out of their homeland into Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh into camps, you know, 120,000, 130,000 are still internally displaced within Burma. And so there's already this extraordinary problem of close to a million people being placed into a camp. And then whether or not they have the ability to travel, to live, to survive during COVID. And then on top of that, we have, you know, the military coup in Burma and the very military leaders who have perpetrated the violence and genocide, as we would call it, name it, in Burma, are now taking over power once again. Burma has been on our country of particular concern for many years. We remain concerned about how that's going to escalate during the course of this year and certainly during 2020, the ways in which the military continued in Rakhine State and other places to perpetrate violence against religious minority communities. Not only the Rohingya, but also Christian communities in multiple states around the country. Those are continuing issues. I think we once again, for the second year in a row, recommended that India be designated a country of particular concern, in part because of national policies that were put in place at the end of 2019, the Citizenship Amendment Act, other citizenship laws, which are excluding Muslims in particular from being able to attain citizenship at the same time that there's efforts to try and actually have communities prove up their citizenship. And there's a lot of concerns about where that's leading to in terms of statelessness and detention and displacement as well, but also because of the kinds of rhetoric that were directed towards Muslim and Christian communities, attacks on places of worship, you know, this continuing state and national efforts to try and demonize the practice of religion for communities that are non-Hindu. And so those are a couple of the places in which we've recommended that they be designated CPCs, like Saudi Arabia, Russia, North Korea, Iran, Eritrea, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. I mean, the kinds of conditions that even people who are in prison in those countries are unfathomable to any of us. And as you mentioned, Nigeria, which we have recommended to be a CPC, and then the State Department actually designated Nigeria as a CPC back in 2020. The other place I'd mentioned is Syria. We've been spending a lot of time, you know, trying to focus on Northeast Syria, which for some time was a place that we saw many religious communities living together and doing so in a way that could actually be something that others could look to as how displaced communities could actually live in more harmony. That is being wiped away by the interventions of Turkey and the Syrian government, but also for the region. How is it that we actually find ways to protect religious communities? It has been something that has been a focal point for the commission.
Anarima, I would like to get into India and some of these other countries of particular concern in a bit. But first, after hearing about Burma, also known as Myanmar, and of course China vis-a-vis the Uyghur population, I'd like to turn to at least one or two of the success stories. And I am specifically referring to Sudan, because your report says that Sudan continued to make remarkable improvements, such as passing something called the Fundamental Rights and Freedoms Act last July, which repealed the apostasy law. It ended flogging for blasphemy. It banned female genital mutilation and even abolished the guardianship law. And you, sir, deemed this progress, particularly in a predominantly Muslim country emerging from more than 20 years of civil war and which still has a transitional government. Talk a bit about the case of Sudan.
Sure. So I was able to actually travel to Sudan in February of 2020 with a USERF delegation. And what I will say is that we had a chance actually to meet with Prime Minister Hamdok and the Council of Ministers in Sudan prior to that visit. And then again, while we were in Sudan, and they are leading, you know, a joint civilian military transitional government that has gotten into place after the brutal and long Islamist rule. And so what we are seeing in Sudan, as you mentioned, is I think of it as the extraordinary role that women played in the movement to actually come to the end of Islamist and this brutal rule, that now the kind of freedoms that women had been advocating for are ones that are slowly coming into place in Sudan. And also, not only are the laws changing, there has been an effort to really look through all of the curriculum from elementary to high school to include and to reference those who are of, you know, different religious backgrounds and religious communities, to stop the kind of rhetoric that suggested that Islam is the rule and the only rule by which anyone could engage and participate and live within the country. That there's been, in a number of ways, just a celebration of holidays. the ability to celebrate Christmas and have that be recognized within Sudan. So there's an opening up in multiple ways of the country to all of the communities that have long lived within Sudan. And I think that Sudan for us, in part because of the kind of honor and grace that we see those in the Council of Ministers and in the Prime Minister himself trying to move the country along, you know, that's something that I do think many of us can look to as a way forward for countries that have lived under authoritarian regimes and very strict religious regimes for a long time.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Kayode Owolabi from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, we will get to Nigeria in just a moment. But first, Anurima Bhargava, talking about the role of women in Sudan, I would like you to tell us a bit about yourself, your personal story. Who nominated you? I believe commissioners on USERF are nominated by members of Congress. And you're a woman in a very prestigious position. And I'd like you to talk about why this position is important to you and a bit about your personal and professional background.
Thank you so much, Carol, for the opportunity to do that. So I was appointed to the commission in December 2018 by Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the commission is made up of 9 commissioners who are appointed by members of different parties. And I think it's been an honor to be able to delve into what are the ways in which communities around the world, their dignity, their ability to thrive have been curtailed and decimated in so many cases by not only state actors, but non-state actors. I come to USERF as a civil rights lawyer who served for many years in the Justice Department in the United States. And then before that, at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, I focused my professional career on really thinking about how do we advocate for the civil rights and the dignity and justice for young people, for students. And so I bring that lens into the international sphere where the ways in which we divide ourselves, we can say that they're different by country and different around the globe, but certainly religion ranks among the key ways in which we divide ourselves, along with race and caste and gender and class. And so to be able to do this work where I've had the opportunity to travel to Sudan, to Iraq, to Vietnam, to Burma, to Bangladesh, to the camps where the Rohingya have been displaced, that it's been a real honor to be able to engage and to push governments around the world on issues for communities and for children and families that have faced the kind of persecution that we're seeing, and frankly, I think is in many ways rising around the world. And being on the commission has been a transformational experience for other reasons, which is, I think, in this time of significant political divides in the United States and elsewhere, that being on the commission has been a chance to work in common purpose and with common values with those who are different political parties and to do so across partisan lines. And I think that has also been extraordinarily important for me and I think for others on the commission to be able to recognize the ways in which we are the same and have similar goals and build some kind of bridges amongst ourselves so that we can build some bridges around the world too.
Well, we wish you all the best as you go forward. And now, Anurima, I want to go back to what USERF classifies as countries of particular concern, some of which you already mentioned. And USERF defines those as governments which engage in or tolerate systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations. And in your 2021 report, these include Burma, also known as Myanmar, which you mentioned, China, obviously, Eritrea, Iran, Nigeria, North Korea, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. And then there are 4 others, which unfortunately made the list: India, Russia, Syria, and Vietnam. First, I want to go to Nigeria. Why has your organization been recommending since 2009 that Nigeria be designated as a country of particular concern?
I'd like to begin by noting that we recommended that Nigeria be a CPC since 2009. We also have recommended that Boko Haram be what we call an entity of particular concern since 2020 in the Islamic State in West Africa province. ISIS-WA recommended, we've recommended that they've also be considered an entity of particular concern this year. And I think there's, you know, a number of reasons why we're concerned about worsening conditions in our view in Nigeria. The detention of individuals for expressing their beliefs by the government and practicing their faith, the targeting and brutal targeting of houses of worship and of religious leaders that has happened without consequence for those who are engaging in that kind of violence. And so we're seeing both from Boko Haram and the Islamic State in West Africa that those attacks are being done by these entities of particular concern in terms of the attacks on houses of worship and religious ceremonies. And those are not actions that are getting consequences, but also we're seeing them proliferate around the country. And so I think for all of those reasons, we've asked that Nigeria be designated a country of particular concern and really want to try and move with Nigeria to try and take significant steps to address the religious freedom violations. We certainly understand the kinds of challenges that the Nigerian government face with the kind of entities of particular concern within the country, but also want to see the government do more to try and address the kinds of incidences that are happening around the country, whether it be by those entities or others.
Exactly. And speaking of Nigeria and, of course, Boko Haram, which you classify as an entity of particular concern along with ISIS or the so-called Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, but staying with Nigeria, how serious does the government take this designation? In other words, are there any specific consequences you can impose or our government can impose?
So I think the recommendation to the State Department, but also the fact that the State Department designated Nigeria CPC, you know, is something that I'm sure the Nigerian government is taking into account. It's very hard to sort of figure out exactly what the response or the reaction is, more so that this is something that is hopefully being addressed as part of the ways in which the United States continues to engage with Nigeria, which is such an important partner in so many ways in Africa and that region. And so I don't know exactly what Nigeria government response has been, but certainly being added to the CPC list is something that nearly every country takes seriously, even if they say they're not paying attention to us. I'll give you China as an example. China sanctioned both the chair and the vice chair of USURF this year, placed sanctions on us for our work. And so, you know, I think in far corners of the world and in near corners of the world, the designation as being recommended as a CPC or being actually designated as a CPC is something that it certainly has ripple effects.
We'll get into, you know, what impact it has on our foreign policy in just a moment. But I wanted to go into Afghanistan. You have classified Afghanistan in a different category as a member of your special watch list. I assume that's less egregious as the CPCs, but you're watching these countries, that is Afghanistan, Algeria, Azerbaijan, Egypt, Indonesia, Iraq, Turkey, and a couple of others. Given that the United States and coalition forces are withdrawing their troops, I assume that there's even greater concern regarding the Taliban should they gain even greater control, especially not only how they treat women and girls, but religious minorities like the Shiite population, Hazaras in particular. How concerned are you about Afghanistan?
Extraordinarily concerned. And obviously, that concern is exacerbated by attacks on a girls' school in which we've seen dozens of young girls lose their life in the past weeks. And so when we think about what's happening in Afghanistan, the Taliban has long been designated an entity of particular concern. And having the Taliban come back into power raises all the concerns that you mentioned, but in particular, the ways in which the Shia Muslim, Sikh, and Hindu communities, and also the Hazaras, have long been persecuted in Afghanistan. We saw attacks on places of worship in 2020. We imagine that's going to continue to happen if there's increased instability in the region. And I think for the United States, having a plan, having a strategy that is going to account for the kind of dangers that religious minority communities are going to be in is extraordinarily important. Having that be part of a considered effort that, you know, in ways that I don't think we did in Syria in the last couple of years. And we're seeing the ramifications of that in terms of the kinds of violence that those in Syria, you know, Northeast Syria in particular, are experiencing. So I think for a lot of reasons, Afghanistan is an area of significant concern for all kinds of reasons right now. And certainly the changes that are happening do not create a situation in which there's open season on religious communities there. I am of Hindu faith and certainly watched with some horror the ways in which Hindu and Sikh places of worship were attacked in Afghanistan. That I think is sadly and unfortunately among much greater horrors and perils to come.
Anarima, I want to go back to the countries of particular concern. You had mentioned India previously, and I wanted to talk about, in particular, the impact of COVID-19, which you also mentioned as a factor in 2020. Some governments, under the guise of health protections, actually committed discrimination using the pretext of COVID-19. I'm wondering, you know, how you see India, the greater Hindu nationalism we're seeing, particularly in the midst of the global coronavirus pandemic. Some analysts are saying that the government has been rather irresponsible. Now we're seeing a resurgence to such a degree, which is becoming extremely concerning for the country, for the people.
Yeah, so the carnage that is taking place in India right now that knows no bounds, knows no bounds of wealth, knows no bounds of region or geography, knows no bounds of religion, that is taking hold in communities across India, you know, certainly been impacted practically everyone I know and in my own family. And so I think in many ways, the concerns that we have about India have extended from, you know, the past couple of years into what's happening now, which is there's been limitations through amendments made to the Foreign Contribution Regulation Act. There's been a bunch of ways in which those non-governmental organizations, those who are trying to actually work within the country, their funding has been dramatically limited because they're not allowed to get contributions from outside of India in a bunch of different ways. And that's in part because of concerns by the government about, you know, interference and in wanting to have a particular ideology and take root across India. And so that's playing out in COVID right now. The constant sort of disinformation and some of the hate that has been directed towards religious communities, attacks on places of worship and religious ceremonies, the sort of national policies that explicitly target Muslim communities that I mentioned, the Citizenship Amendment Act and sort of the process around a national register of citizens that is ongoing, and frankly, anti-conversion laws that have been passed in multiple states and continue to be passed in 2020. All of that is contributing to a situation in which the things that are necessary to address the pandemic, which is to try and be open and communicate about how it is that people need to engage with one another. I will say that, like, the extraordinary efforts of communities on the ground to help one another, I think, has also extended across, you know, all of the divides that I'm talking about. And so that's what India is, and is extraordinary to see. But I do think that the government policies and the kind of government rhetoric that we've seen out of India have been problematic and exacerbated the kind of ongoing problems that we're seeing during the surge, the second surge of COVID, which, you know, we have not seen the likes of anywhere in the world until now.
Indeed, I guess India being such an important strategic ally of the United States, the world's largest democracy, I imagine it makes it more difficult for any administration to deal with a strong ally and have to, you know, be mindful of this type of mismanagement and also oppression of some of the minorities. And that leads me to ask you, what are your key U.S. policy recommendations for the Biden administration going forward?
So I think there's a number of areas that we have already made recommendations to the Biden administration about. Certainly want to make sure that, first and foremost, those who have been partners in this work within the administration, the State Department, so having Ambassador for Religious Freedom, that those positions are ones that are filled and active, that we've made recommendations that were recently taken up after some bumps along the way around lifting the refugee resettlement ceiling, and in particular, making sure that we are allowing those who have faced such significant religious persecution and violence around the world have a place here in the United States to come to when we're advocating so strongly on their behalf around the world. And then, of course, there are many ways in which, you know, whether it be countries that have long been allies like India, how to actually make sure that the religious concerns are part of the bilateral conversations and negotiations that are happening, that are part of the ways in which allyship is formed. And so we advocate for religious freedom and, frankly, addressing religious persecution and violence being something that is very much part of the equation for many countries around the world, those who are allies, those who we are trying to put pressure on. And then outside of the recommendations that we make and the highlighting, which I think is really important, to have a commission that is really focused on religious persecution and violence and tries to make sure that our government and our Congress know what is happening around the world, you know, that's part of the key work, is shining this light, which I can't underscore how important just doing that is in a time where it's very hard to figure out, you know, what can be trusted in terms of information and how do you actually understand what's happening within countries. So the highlighting, the recommendations themselves, and then, you know, the number of the recommendations we have made and continue to make about sanctions, both visa and financial and other sanctions against officials around the world who have engaged in and allowed for and incited religious violence and persecution. Certainly will continue to push for that. For example, for the United States government to take swift action when it comes to the top madonna, the Burmese military, to continue to make sure that we think about the ways in which for Uyghurs, not only do we have that be part of the ways in which we think about our engagement with China diplomatically, but also our engagement with China economically and in business. We've certainly been concerned about the support that continues to flow to the Chinese government, financial support and financial engagement and economic engagement, without regard for the ways in which that can be, you know, decimating the Uyghur population. So I think there's many ways in which we are making recommendations to the Biden administration. I certainly continue to believe that key among them is to center and to keep front and center the kinds of religious considerations that we have the privilege of being able to focus on. So that's, I think, continuing to be our role and what we were mandated to do.
Certainly, you're shining the light on these types of egregious violations is critically important. And the fact that you are having an impact on policy, just want to reconfirm that you have been able to get the Biden administration to lift the ceiling on refugee resettlement here in the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct. And, you know, there are so many who have worked on this issue for so long, some who were previously at USERF, who've gone on to lead efforts in this area in different organizations. And I think it was both during the Trump administration and during the Biden administration, we unanimously as a commission recommended that the refugee resettlement ceiling be lifted. It got to record lows, historic lows at 15,000. And that's just, you know, unconscionable. And so, you know, for this fiscal year to 62,500 and then going forward to 125,000 plus, you know, on average, it's been about 95,000 per year over the course of the last two decades. And so, you know, it's important that those numbers are where they are. We'd obviously like them to always be higher if they could, to take account of what's happening around the world right now. And most importantly, for there to be immediate action, because there are people who have been waiting and there are people who we've been advocating for who are, you know, facing religious violence, persecution, and would certainly, if they're not able to come to the United States, who need immediate assistance. And so we call on the Biden administration to do that as quickly as possible.
And lastly, Anarima, as the chair going forward of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, any particular priorities you have this year going forward, even though we're already almost halfway through the year?
I would say a couple things. I think it's important that we look to the places in which there have been movements towards greater community, bridging divides, finding ways in which people can actually, as we've seen throughout history and certainly around the world right now, people during COVID and otherwise, we've been so proximate to each other in stranger ways than we have in the past. And how do we make sure that coming out of COVID, we can understand a little bit different in every corner of the world, how we're dependent upon each other, how we're close to one another, that the borders that we're talking about are not ones that we can rely on or somehow make stronger or more distinct to suggest that, you know, we are different from the person next to us, because we've all been in this together. That and really seeing the ways in which women in Sudan and Burma have been leading efforts to try and address authoritarian regimes that have been couched in religious hate and intolerance. We're seeing that kind of leadership. I'm hoping that we can continue to lift up some of those stories so that things don't feel so bleak everywhere as they have for so much of 2020 for all of us. And then to understand what we've been trying to do at the commission in terms of the ways in which there are trends, the long arm of China. So not just what's happening within the country, but the ways in which
China has played a role in what's happened in places like Burma, a significant role, and the ways in which technologies and social media and so much else is exacerbating religious divides. Those are the kinds of things that I think we continue to try and focus on, the ways in which blasphemy laws are playing out around the world. We had a significant report on that in the past year and want to continue to focus on that. And also understanding that, unfortunately, hate can catch on in ways that we've seen in terms of the rise of anti-Semitism, the rise across Europe, the ways in which Muslim communities are facing persecution in all kinds of ways around the world, and certainly also the rise of nationalism and making sure that continue to be a light and shining a light on what the consequences of that are.
Anurima Bhargava is chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Anurima, thank you so much for giving us an assessment of the state of religious freedom around the world and why it is so important as a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.